Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Craig Unger, New York Times bestselling author of American Compromise: How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump, and Related Tales of Sex, Greed, Power, and Treachery. My guest has also authored six other best-selling books, including House of Bush, House of Saud, and House of Trump, House of Putin. He has extensive experience covering national security, the Middle East, and other political issues in multiple magazines, and he appears frequently as a political analyst on MSNBC and CNN. Welcome, Craig Unger. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the way that you begin your book. It had been the worst of times, like in Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, but without the hope and light. I love that quote. Tell me what this phrase meant to you personally when you were writing this book on Donald Trump and what it means to you now.
Well, I think this is very much an historic new era. And I also think it's a lot of people have, we've all been bombarded with one story after another. I think we all have Trump fatigue. but one thing I try to do in the book is weave it together in terms of the broad historic forces that are at work. And I think Trump himself was, I mean, there was and remains this incredible cult of personality.
Yes.
That seemed to render his followers completely numb to factual reality. And we see a real attack on truth, on factual reality again and again and again. And one thing I try to do in the book is to set up these broad cultural forces that I think are at war, that it's not just Trump, it's more than that. Russia's a big part of it. And in a way, this is, to me, World War III, but it's a war without bombs, bullets, or boots on the ground. It's a war with cyber warfare, with a war on truth, on reality, and it's still going on. Even though Trump is gone, we have to get to the bottom of it if we're to actually win this war and stop it from happening again.
Right. So the main point is it's not a person; it's a phenomenon.
These are big historic forces. And I think Trump does have this unique cult of personality. And I worked here for many, many years in New York as he was becoming a star. So I was in New York Magazine when he was doing his first big successful real estate venture, which was the Grand Hyatt Hotel, right next to Grand Central Station. Our offices were just around the corner. And he was not a superstar then. He was just becoming a star in New York City. He was in his early 30s at the time. But this was the time, and none of us knew it, of course, when he was really being cultivated by the KGB.
Okay, back then, did you see the beginning of this? Were there any sort of preliminary hints of how this was developing? You said he didn't have that magnetic force yet, that the forces were beginning.
Right. I mean, one thing in retrospect, it's easier to see, but his lawyer was Roy Cohn, who was the dark satanic prince of fixers. And in allying with Roy Cohn, Trump was very much a mobster and Roy Cohn was very much a mob lawyer. And in retrospect, I think it's quite easy to see that come together. This was not a guy who played by the rules. He always had another agenda.
Right.
It was all brute force. Never give in, never give in. Just deny, 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 and accuse the other side of doing exactly what you've been doing. All along.
So the quality never changed, just the field of operation.
Right.
It is mind-boggling for us, for the public, to consider the full impact of everything, to follow all the threads and to cope with everything else that has gone on, all the threats and the stressors. What was it like for you to research this book, to go through all the statements of so many high-level sources, and I understand thousands of pages of FBI investigations, police investigations, articles in English, Russian, and Ukraine? What was it like to plunge into this wealth of...
Well, I mean, part of investigative reporting is fun, and it's like being on the hunt for something. And, you know, one of the first things where I began to see an overall pattern was I started going through the real estate records of 721 Fifth Avenue, which is Trump Tower. That's the address for Trump Tower. And if you look at the purchase and sale agreements going back through the ages, you just start seeing one Russian name after another. And then you Google the Russian name, you see, oh, the FBI says they're in the Russian mafia. And I ended up with 13 people who fit that description in one way or another. And you don't have that many coincidences in a row. I mean, I don't know how many Russian mobsters live in your house, but it's probably fewer than 13.
Right.
Or 13, something suspicious would be going on there. So you could start to see those patterns, but it wasn't always clear what they meant immediately.
Right.
And when you, but when you started putting them in a chronology, what I started to see is, you know, we all thought we won the Cold War. The Soviet Union crumbled in I think it was 91. So theoretically, we won the Cold War. But in fact, when you look at those documents, you see something else was going on behind the scenes. And the KGB had a completely different plan that was very, very secret. And it was funneling money from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union into all these commodity firms that were run by the KGB and the Russian mafia. And they later came, they allied with Trump. They bought Trump real estate and they laundered his money through their money through Trump real estate. And they came to his aid when Trump had gone belly up in Atlantic City in the 90s by overexpanding and had one bankruptcy after another. It was not The Apprentice that saved him financially. That didn't come until 2004. But by 2002, the Russians were pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into Trump investments.
Was there one aha moment where you sort of you recognized the full pattern, or was it sort of a creeping realization as you began to see all the pieces?
It was a little of both. I mean, at a certain point, you realize the pattern continues. And after those first 13, you start looking elsewhere. And I didn't realize initially, I mean, most Americans, when they think of the mafia, they think, oh, the Italian mafia, like,
right,
is at war with the FBI. Well, it's very, very different with the Russian mafia. They are allied with the KGB and its successors. So they are, organized crime in Russia is part of their intelligence sector, and they work in concert with it. So that's when things start to make sense on a whole nother level. And you see that Trump has been allying with them for decades, really. And one thing I found out in this book, in American Compromise, is that there were quite a number of people who had contact with Trump who really were KGB agents and who I have sort of outed for the first time. And that goes back to the Grand Hyatt Hotel when he's buying TV sets from them for the Grand Hyatt Hotel. Where does he go but to an electronics store that's run by Soviet emigres who I report for the first time were really working for the KGB. They were spotter agents for the KGB. Their role was to find suitable recruits who could work as assets for the KGB, and they fixated on Donald Trump by 1980.
You couldn't come up with so many coincidences if you tried.
Right. I mean, when you think about it, you know, Hyatt is a big blue chip firm. Why are they buying TV sets from a little? There've got to be reliable third party vendors out there. This is America.
Right.
Why are they going to this little place that's run by the KGB? And you can confirm that just by interviewing your local Russian mobster or going to the FBI and all that. And so it was not that hard to confirm, really.
So tell us about this ex-KGB colonel who said that he's been an asset for, who confirmed that Trump has been an asset for 40 years.
Yuri Spitz was actually a major in the KGB, but he's a fascinating guy. And when you start using former spies as sources, you have to be very careful and vet them very, very carefully. Yuri is a fascinating figure, and I think he's been a vocal critic of Putin for more than 20 years. And that's really important. And if you know the story of Alexander Litvinenko, the former FSB agent who dug up a lot of dirt on Putin and paid for it with his life, he was poisoned with polonium. Well, he and Yuri were partners. They worked together. And Yuri, when Litvinenko was assassinated, Yuri was the key witness at the inquest in the UK, in London. And he actually fingered the actual assassin. So I think he's done a lot of things that are really quite courageous and risky. When I started talking to him, it just, it went, you know, you're never sure what you're gonna get, but I ended up having literally dozens and dozens of interviews with him. I mean, certainly more than a dozen formal taped ones, but then since then we've had probably 50 or more phone conversations. And he's very, very knowledgeable. Part of his knowledge comes from the fact that when he was with the KGB, he was stationed in Washington at the Washington Residentura. And he was actually recruiting Americans to spy for the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, his comrades in the New York Residentura were recruiting Donald Trump. So there were parallels there, and Yuri knew a lot of the people who were involved personally, and he had personal knowledge in 1987 when the KGB circulated an internal memo, and it celebrated the acquisition of a new recruit, a new asset they had recruited, who was performing his first active measure. An active measure is sort of a disinformation operation. And of course, it was Donald J. Trump. Who was acting as an asset, and Yuri actually saw this document pass his desk. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy. But when you look at what Trump did, he put out a full-page ad. That was the active measure they were celebrating in the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. And it had all these wacky ideas for American foreign policy that were insanely pro-Russian, that we have to discontinue our alliance with Japan, which has been a good ally for 70 years now or so. Mm-hmm. That NATO was robbing us blind and we should get out of NATO. Those kind of things were in that, and those were the KGB talking points from that era.
Is there anything you wish you could have confirmed more that you couldn't?
Well, I wish I had the actual document.
The memo.
I didn't use anything. Everything I used in the book, though Yuri is often the primary source, I was able to back up. I didn't use it unless I was able to back it up with other sources. So, for example, a former federal prosecutor used to go to the out with the FBI, and they were staking out this electronics store because they knew it was a KGB front. So I was able to back up stuff like that. I mean, people, you know, always say, well, what's the smoking gun? What's the smoking gun? That's not the way I view this operation. And part of it is, one of the big things I think people don't understand about intelligence, and to me, this is where Robert Mueller really failed. He really dropped the ball. The Mueller investigation was supposed to be a counterintelligence investigation. Instead, it ended just as a criminal investigation. And criminal investigations, are supposed to catch people in crimes. Well, a really smart intelligence operation is designed to operate within the law. So when you read the book, you see all these actions take place that in themselves are not technically illegal. It's perfectly okay for Donald Trump to talk to KGB agents that he wants to develop a Trump Tower in Moscow. It's ridiculous, but it's not illegal.
Right.
And he is being, you know, they're dangling this bauble in front of him and getting him to do what they want. Similarly, I tell the story of Donald Trump Jr. This is an event that takes place just before the election in 2016. And Donald Jr. goes to Paris. He delivers a talk before a French think tank. He's paid a lot of money for it. All, again, perfectly legal. What's wrong here is that the think tank is really a front for Russian intelligence. And Trump Jr. is being given the talking points that Russia wants his father to execute as president. And sure enough, in 2017, Donald J. Trump, as president, withdraws American troops from Syria as the Russians wanted. We abandon our Kurdish allies, and Russia sort of takes a much more dominant role in the region.
So this is, in fact, how they get away with it.
Right, exactly, exactly. And that's why I think more than ever, this is really important to focus on now. If we don't, prosecute Trump to the full extent of the law, but also get to the bottom of this more than I, as one reporter, can do. If we don't do it, effectively, we're saying it's okay and it'll happen again. You know, if a Boeing 737 crashes, you just don't say, oh, well, they're dead, we'll forget about it.
Oh, well, right.
Yeah, but no, you have to understand what happened or it will happen again.
Well, realistically, do you think we will get to the bottom of this?
I'm pretty pessimistic, and I've had 50 years of investigative reporting. We never get to the bottom of anything.
It's discouraging.
Yeah, and even bipartisan commissions, people say, oh, now we'll really get the truth. No, there's a lot of political horse trading that goes on, and we won't reveal that if you won't reveal this. And so it's not that we always get to the bottom of things, but I think we, you know, I have to press as hard as I can for that.
Sure. Kind of thing. Yeah, one hopes that through time.
Right, right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Jeffrey Epstein and his sex trafficking operation. Most of us in the public, we know that it provided a source and marketplace for the dirty secrets of the rich and powerful, such as Donald Trump. But how did Epstein's operation influence Trump most in relation to Russia? And in that whole subject area, was there anything that surprised you?
Well, I actually would almost reverse the framework. Is that what did the Russia? Trump and Epstein were very close friends from 1987 to the early 2000s, for about a 15-year period. But they had a big, big, bitter falling out in the early 2000s over a piece of real estate that was ended up being bought by a Russian, Dmitry Rybolov. And Epstein wanted that mansion more than anything, and Trump stole it out from under him and then flipped it for twice the price to the Russians. But what you see in Epstein's operation, and not long after that, Epstein showed one of my sources a photo of Trump with two very young girls, and they were not fully clothed, and there was a stain on Trump's trousers. Now, you can make it, I didn't see the photo, that's how it was described to me, but it was described as being very suggestive, and that Epstein was hinting that he had stuff on Trump. And Epstein had secretly recorded enormous amounts of sexual activities going on at his various houses in New York, in Palm Beach, in the Virgin Islands, and so forth. And he had at least 478 DVDs that were seized by the Palm Beach Sheriff Office. Now, we don't know if those are that appears to be compromised. Of a lot of rich and powerful people. We don't know everyone who had access to it. Presumably Epstein's lawyers did, presumably the prosecutors had it, presumably Ghislaine Maxwell may have had it, but I don't know. Some of the girls may have had some of it. Some of it may have been compromise with regard to corporate spying that was going on. The girls could be used for corporate spying as well. No, there's no better place than to spill secrets than in the bedroom.
Right.
So there are all these unanswered questions, and I tried to trace them as best I could. And to be honest, You could go on for years doing this, and I think people will. But one of the Palm Beach sheriffs, deputy sheriffs I talked to was a man named John Mark Dugan. And he and I tracked him down by phone in Moscow. And he had fled Florida for Moscow with 478 DVDs in a vault. And I got a photo that I had been on his Facebook page of him with a man named Pavel Borodin. And that's probably a name that is not familiar to most of your listeners. But Borodin was essentially Vladimir Putin's mentor. And he's in charge of roughly $1 trillion worth of capital in Russia today. And there he was with Dugin, who had 478 DVDs to sell. And you can just imagine what happened or hasn't happened. I don't know if it's happened or not, but that appears to have been what at least people were, you know, an act that they were trying to do. He was trying to make a sale of compromise to Russia.
Where do you think these tapes are now?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I would also look at the law firms because they had to have some of them. And one of the things that's just amazing is the power that's being wielded by two or three major white shoe law firms. If you look at the Epstein operation, the prosecutor, Alex Acosta, who later ended up as Secretary of Labor, he had been at the firm of Kirkland and Ellis, and all of Epstein's lawyers were also at Kirkland and Ellis. And William Barr, who became Attorney General, was at Kirkland and Ellis. And Brian Benkowski, who was appointed head of the criminal division, was also at Kirkland and Ellis. So, the conflicts are just overwhelming, so many cross conflicts. And it also works with the Russians as well. You have, you know, the same firms, Jones Day and Kirkland & Ellis, also represent an enormous number of powerful Russians. They are Vladimir Putin's law firms of choice. And, you know, the United States, theoretically, is trying to enforce these sanctions against the Russian oligarchs. But right. The Russian oligarchs, meanwhile, are using the same lawyers Donald Trump has, and they're working in the White House with Donald Trump, and they've taken over the Justice Department under William Barr. So the conflicts are just off the charts.
The system is very convoluted and hard. And you wanted to look in those safes. I'm sure you wanted to go into those law firms.
I actually did see one video. Dugan showed me one, but it was... it was a little disappointing, to be honest. It was very grainy, black and white. Some of these were from 20 years ago when technology isn't quite, now we all have HD on our phones or whatever. But in those days, they didn't, and I couldn't recognize the guy, and, you know, there's no sound, which kind of.
Right, no subtitles saying who it is. I know that some skeptics of this asset theory may say that Trump's behavior is, you know, simply his desire to emulate Vladimir Putin. For people who see that those coincidences may in fact just be coincidences, or that he's just emulating Putin, what do you have anything you'd like to say to?
Yes, I do.
Something you can say on the radio.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it is it started way before Putin. This is Putin didn't rise for another 20 years. So if you look at the first money laundering, which when I write about it, the first incident I found was in 1984 in who was part of the Russian mob came to Trump Tower. He had $6 million in cash, and he said, I'll take 5 condos. Trump doesn't, Trump doesn't say, oh, where did you get all that money? He's like a good mobster. He takes the money and knows not to ask those questions. But in that transaction, that was considered possible money laundering because it met the two key predicates. One, it was an anonymous transaction through a shell company, and two, it was all cash, so there are no bank records were necessary. Well, you can see doing that a couple of times maybe and saying, oops, I laundered some money. Oops, I may have laundered money. Maybe 6 or 8 times. Trump did it at least 1,300 times.
Yeah.
And no, you don't have that many coincidences. And there's a, this has been hard to prosecute because you can't really prove Trump's state of mind. But there are legal concepts known as willful ignorance or deliberate blindness, that is intentionally not knowing facts, because it'll get you in trouble. The less you know, the better. Well, I would argue if you do that 1,300 times in a row, that's a pattern, and that suggests he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, it seems to pass the common sense test.
I think so, yeah. I'm not a lawyer, but that's what it seems like to me.
Let's go to so far this fascinating year of 2021. We've experienced the terrifying Capitol riot January 6th, and then we had the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. And of course, now the talk of having the 9/11 style commission to investigate what really happened and who was involved. Do you have any insights what's going to happen with this, or any predictions, shall I say? And do you intend to investigate this any further?
Well, I think we're definitely moving into a new phase, and there's so many different things going on. Everything is so fluid that I hesitate to make any predictions. Except Trump, I mean, I think the New York district attorney really is going after him, and they've hired a new lawyer who is quite celebrated as a prosecutor. So I applaud that, and I hope it, you know, I hope it goes forward as much as it can. I'm a little disturbed by how little the FBI, I mean, maybe this will come out, but so far it hasn't. And my research shows, again, this goes back 40 years. And if this is not racketeering, I'm not a lawyer, but this appears to be organized crime. And it's crime and it's organized, you know? And if there's not racketeering here, I'd like to know why. I got a lot of information from FBI files. So they must know this stuff. It's in their files, or I can help them find it. And I don't know why. It really should have been out long before the election, and it's just a catastrophe that it was covered up. And I think that Mueller didn't pursue it is a disaster, and that's one of the things. But it's clear that he will be prosecuted in a lot of different venues. I'm sure there's cases in Georgia about interfering in the election.
Right.
I think that the DA in New York will find out stuff about massive loans from Russia that went through Deutsche Bank and so forth. But, you know, I don't know if they're going to, what we really need, I believe, is a serious counterintelligence investigation. And I'm kind of dubious that we're going to get it. And it may just be that the material I'm pursuing is too taboo. It's interesting that the way that my book is being received, because in the rest of the world, in Russia, in Great Britain, it's a huge story, in Israel, all over the world, and much less so in the United States. And all I can think of is maybe it is taboo for us that something so dark actually happened, and that we are loath to admit it. I would love for some official bodies to get deeply, deeply involved. I think it affects not just Trump, but the entire Republican Party. I mean, look at the way they are married to him even now. I mean, after he lost, you know, it just seems like a death spiral that they're in. But they are defending Russia as much as Trump did, in a way. And Trump was not the only one who was affected by all this. If you look at Mitch McConnell, and you'll see, is it just a coincidence that Oleg Deripaska started a coal mine in Kentucky, you know, or that Leonard Blavatnik, who was a Russian oligarch, but he's a naturalized American citizen, that he's given millions and millions to the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. And you can go on and on like this. I mean, I've already done two books on it, and I know the first one was House of Trump, House of Putin. And I, you know, to be honest, I feel like I'm just scratching the surface. There's so much out there. It is just unbelievable. And again, what is depressing is that it seems like we don't have the real mechanisms even for getting to the bottom of this. Congressional oversight was just destroyed by the Republicans. We have to get that back. And Biden has to, you know, put in serious inspectors general and all the federal agencies and so forth.
I can't help wonder, I'm also a clinician. I can't help wondering if it would just, the reason why some of these things or these things can't come out is that it would just change our very identity.
Right. Well, it's also the, you're almost asking the fox to investigate the hen house in a lot of these. And you know, there are so many failures. It's just astounding. You know, so you want to get the FBI to do a counterintelligence investigation. Well, you know, the former head of the FBI, William Sessions, hired Semion Mogilevich, became lawyer for Semion Mogilevich, who was one of the great villains of this whole thing. Another head of the FBI, Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, worked for Prevagen, which was fighting the Magnitsky Act. And if you remember the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower, that was the company involved. So all the lawyers I mentioned at Kirkland and Ellis and Jones Day, some of them make more than $10 million a year working for Russian oligarchs. I mean, excuse me, that means you're an intelligence operative for Vladimir Putin and you're being well paid for it. And they're not going to, you know,
that's give motivation. Up
for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any particular take on the January 6th events that come from all your research or something that you think has not come out yet?
Well, you know, and Russia's role in it has been buried a little, but they are very much fueling QAnon, which is an important part of this. And, you know, one of the things I'm just keeping an eye on is, is Trump really going to run again? I kind of don't believe it. I mean, I think he'll be so tied up in court that he may have to flee the country or right. I don't know what's going to happen, but this is not over yet for him. And that said, who will rise to power to take his place? I think it looks like a bloodbath for the Republican Party in the future because they have to go, you know, all the way as Trumpsters and pro-Russian in order to win the primaries. But, you know, I don't think that will wash when it comes to the general election with the Democrats, both in the midterms and I hated that we just finished one election. We're already discussing that.
Right. Let us recuperate first. Yeah. Fascinating. One last question. What are you working on next? And do you have any ideas of when we can see that in print?
Oh, it's much too early.
I'm
still promoting this. And I, you know, when a book comes out, I sort of stick with it for probably 3 months or so to make sure it gets out to as many people as possible. I don't know the next step yet. But if you look at my last 5 books, they actually are of a piece and they are all sort of the Republican Party's war against democracy. Mm-hmm. And what I try to write about is how unseen power works. That is, you know, it's not what most, you know, if you just didn't read the daily papers, you're not going to get the full story. And I try to go way below the surface and look at the other mechanisms that are making things work. And it's, you know, it's, I think Biden's gotten off to a very good start, but it's much too early to say how all of this will play out. He has a razor thin majority. He's got to strengthen it. And we'll see how it plays out. I don't know. But I mean, we've got to have a, you know, though I generally vote Democratic, you need another party in there somehow, you know, and right now the Republicans, I mean, one of the things that's really astounding is it looks like 70 million people or more believe a completely different factual reality.
That's, yes. And that's what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not over. And we have to cure that problem.
Right.
And it's barely being addressed. And I think a big part of the problem is social media. I mean, it's quite simply, Facebook makes billions of dollars by promoting lies and fantasies and fraudulent conspiracies and Russian propaganda. You know, and for me as a journalist, it's tragic because there's over $100 billion a year in advertising that used to go to newspapers and magazines and now goes to social media, which is putting out Russian propaganda and QAnon fantasies and all sorts of other nonsense.
So it seems like we have to learn how to manage social media or face the repercussions.
Right. I think we absolutely have to regulate social media. And more than that, we have to impose regulations that eliminate the kind of money laundering I've been talking about. There's about $30 or $40 trillion in dark money and flight capital and illegal money from illegal operations that is trying, desperately wants to be laundered. And one of the best ways to do it has been real estate, where, you know, you can just walk in and buy 20 condos that cost $5 million each, and bam, we've laundered $100 million.
Sounds like we need more investigative journalists. We need an army of people like you.
Well, it's not a great way to make a living.
Well, I wish you much luck with this book getting further readership in the United States. Craig, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed talking with you. Anything else? Any last words you'd like to say for our audience?
No, it's just really that I think the largest thing is we can't let go of this now. And I know people have Trump fatigue, and I do, believe me, worse than any of you do. But we still have to get to the bottom of it and to make sure it doesn't happen again. And that means we need a serious counterintelligence investigation. And I've done the best I can, but it's time for the government to put something together.
Right. So moving on is investigating the past. Because we need to.
Absolutely. I do what a lot of people don't do, which is, you know, in the newspapers or TV, it's all about what happened today. I want to see how we got there.
Right.
And how it all started out.
Right. Okay. And I think we will stop right there. Craig Unger, it was a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
To contact Craig Unger, please write him at craig.unger@me.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Thank you.